Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. You know, in the past, we've talked about the phenomenon of coronal mass ejections from the sun. Now, usually abbreviated CME, these blasts of particles from the sun can cause anything from a very mild aurora seen in the far north to major disruptions in communications and possibly even damage to the electrical grid itself, as was seen in 1989 in Quebec and elsewhere in the northeast of North America. The reason I want to revisit the subject today is because of an event in 2012 that was a close call for the planet Earth. Well, at least that part of planet Earth that relies on electricity and computers and things like that. Today, we're rejoined by Lika Guhathakurta, NASA astrophysicist and program scientist for the STEREO mission and lead scientist on NASA's Living with a Star initiative. Dr. Guhathakurta works as a scientist, mission designer, instrument builder, teacher, and spokesperson for NASA's Heliophysics Division. So I've asked Lika to come on the program to discuss that 2012 event, help us put it into some context. Lika, I really appreciate you rejoining us today.
I appreciate the opportunity. I think this was a significant event that I am glad to spend some time on it.
Great. So for those listeners who may not have heard the prior podcast, how about a quick background on what a CME is?
So CMEs are this massive amount of energized, magnetized particles that are essentially belched out by the sun from time to time. Often they arise from regions that we see with our unaided eyes as sunspots. If they are large enough, these are dark regions where the magnetic field is really strong. These are also called active regions. And so CMEs will often emanate from such regions, but not necessarily always. And so these structures can be huge, huge, much bigger than our planet, other bigger planets. So and they carry matter that is of the order of 1 to 10 billion tons, if you can really comprehend the amount of matter and energy that something like this would carry. If you're looking at it, you know, through our telescopes, as we do, they would appear to you as being sort of innocuous in that they are very tenuous. They are almost gossamer-like, yet it carries so much energy, magnetized energy, that when it comes and impacts our planetary environment, for planet Earth, it's our magnetosphere, that's the force shield, it can cause all sorts of interesting effects.
So this is a blast of matter, maybe like water coming off, being flung off the end of a towel. These are particles, right? This is actual physical matter. 10 billion tons, you mentioned, is a possible amount. Seems like a lot. And it's flying towards the Earth. And I can imagine that they vary a lot in intensity. How are these classified? How do we put them in a scale?
It is not that we put the CMEs on the scale as such, but we do put their impacts on scale. So, for example, NOAA will classify the impact and the severity of a phenomenon like a coronal mass ejection or a solar flare, which is a very intense disruption of a magnetic region on the sun, very localized, unlike a coronal mass ejection, which is very broad in scope, but with tremendous amount of energy. I do want to point out that while you mentioned that this is actually matter, yes, in a sense it is matter, but it is the fourth state of matter. It is plasma. So all the material that we experience and that's thrown out is actually ionized. So these are electrons, protons, or ionized atoms. These are not the kind of neutral atmosphere that we live in. So these are magnetized material. Magnetic field plays a very, very important role. In fact, that's what makes this distinction between space weather and terrestrial weather. Even though we use the name weather, they are physically very different phenomenon, and the magnetic field plays a crucial role in that distinction.
So we've got this plasma flying towards us. It's protons. It's neutrons.
Electrons.
Maybe electrons. Just
electrons.
Is it stripped atoms coming at us with having lost one or more electrons, and so it's all charged up, ready to go. So let's talk about that 2012 event. I believe it happened in July of 2012. How big was it? Let's talk about that.
Before I talk about how big that particular event was, it is probably instructive to kind of understand what do we mean by big, because big or extreme event has different meaning to different people. It's almost like in the eyes of the beholder. So, you know, we kind of characterize everything today with this extreme event that we observed in 1859 called the Carrington event, which has actually become a touchstone of heliophysics and space weather. So if I compare it to Carrington event, which is the worst we believe we have observed, even though it was long time ago when, you know, we didn't have the modern technology as we do today, how does it compare it to that scale? That's kind of one question we want to ask when we are trying to define the word big. But there are many other ways of defining big, okay? We have had the biggest geomagnetic storm that occurred in March of 1989 that you just described when we had the Hydro-Québec failure. We have had the biggest solar particle event occurred in September of 1859. That is the Carrington storm. We have had low-latitude auroras observed in February 1872. These are some of the extremes I'm describing. Mm-hmm. The fastest CME on record, you know, up until now, crossed the Sun-Earth divide in only 14 hours. And this was in August of 1972. The most intense sudden ionospheric disturbance that happens with flares occurred during the Halloween storms of 2003. So these are kind of many different ways of describing how an event was significant and big. And each one of these would have different impacts. On that scale, this particular CME was one of the fastest that we have observed in space age. It comes pretty close to the 1972 CME, except slightly slower, perhaps. So it was traveling at a speed of the order of, say, 2,500 plus minus 500 kilometers per second. It took roughly 19 hours for this CME to plow through the interplanetary medium and strike our magnetosphere. It carried with it a magnetic field that is very important. What magnetic field the CME is carrying determines really the severity of the geomagnetic storm that it will cause. And that was significantly high. We have done lots of modeling on this particular event. And what we find, there's a parameter called DST that essentially, the term is disturbance storm time. This is a number that we calculate from ground-based magnetometers around the equator. And what this does is it actually measures how hard Earth's magnetic field shakes when a CME hits. So we kind of had calculated, extrapolated that number for Carrington event. And we knew that number for the 1989 storm. If we do same kind of calculation, remember, this is extrapolation because this CME did not hit Earth, then what we find that the DST would have been sort of a factor of two higher than the one we experienced in 1989. And that's pretty significant.
A factor of two. That's very significant.
Now, remember, these are all models now. Yep. We are using data, and we are doing simulations, and we are coming up with these results. And this is what the scientists are doing.
Sure, sure. You won't really know until it happens in the real world. But we have the data. We collected some data on how fast this was traveling and the magnetic charge it was carrying with us. You mentioned it came close. How close did it come?
Are you talking in terms of
time?
Distance to no. It didn't. So the Stereo A was actually on the west limb of the sun and beyond. So this CME never threatened our planet, but the CME actually blasted many other planets because it was very large in scope. And, Stereo A being, of course, very much the focus of the CME, and that's why we could get such wonderful data, but it was not at all in the direction of our planet.
But I'd read somewhere, and maybe you can correct me on this, I read that if the timing had been off by a week, that could have been different.
Yeah, but week is a long time, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the sun rotates every sort of 27 days, right? It's central meridian. So if you have a week, that's a huge sort of quadrature, almost. That's a big distance.
Right. Okay. So it blasted safely off towards Stereo A, which did manage to catch a lot of the data on it. So if it had hit, though, if we had been sort of right in the barrels of this, what would have happened, do you think?
Well, I'm a scientist. Mm-hmm. And I work at NASA, and our job is to actually understand these events and not really predict this. Even NOAA will spend a lot of time, NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center, really analyzing the data and sort of giving out information on impact. So if I look at what NOAA does, they have several scales. They have indices for such events. So one is a geomagnetic storm index, which is disturbances in the geomagnetic field caused by CME in the solar wind, okay? And they have a scale of G1 to G5. They have a solar radiation storm. And again, these elevated levels of radiation that occur when the number of energetic particles increase, which can happen through a solar flare or the shock generated by the coronal mass ejection as it is plowing through the interplanetary medium, again, has a scale of S1 to S5. Then we have radio blackouts, disturbances of the ionosphere that is caused by X-ray emissions from the sun. And that scale is R1 to R5. This was a significant enough event that, one would probably put it in the category of G4, G5. And if you kind of go and then look at the NOAA charts that kind of associates the impacts with that kind of activity scale, it would say that there would be widespread voltage control problems and protective system problems can occur. Some grid systems can experience complete collapse or blackout. Spacecraft operations will be hampered, uplink, downlink, and tracking of satellites, radiation level would go up. So if there is, extravehicular activities going on by astronauts, they might be in danger. There'll be complete high-frequency radio blackout on the entire sunlit side of the Earth. Navigation would be hampered. And all of this would then lead to the corollary, effect, because we depend on many of these functionalities to work properly for our modern technological society to function the way it does today. So it had the potential, but that's all we can say because we haven't experienced it. And without the real data, all we can do is do the extrapolation.
Now, I want to go back to something you said before, which was this was traveling so fast that it crossed that gulf between the sun and the Earth in 19 hours? Is that correct?
In 19 hours, right. And this is a distance that's about 93 million miles.
In 19 hours. So This question then becomes, how far, when do we get our first read of something like that coming? Let's assume that this one was traveling towards us, crossing the Gulf in 19 hours. Our satellites are some distance in between the sun and the Earth. How much warning would we have had in time if this had been coming right at us?
We would have had pretty much the same amount of warning. So we are fortunate today, and I mean, right now, it will always not be like this, in that we have complete coverage of the sun from all angles, sort of 24 hours, 7 days a week. We have Solar Dynamics Observatory along the sun-earth line. We have the two stereo spacecraft. Now, of course, they are behind, and they will kind of turn around and come back again. They are kind of following the same orbit as Earth, but one leading, one lagging. We have SOHO, again, at L1 point, okay? So all of these spacecraft are actually giving us an unprecedented view of the front side and the far side of the sun. So if there is an active region that produces a coronal mass ejection, we actually catch it with our satellite. We know it. And because we have so many satellites in place and some of them distributed away from sun-earth line, we are better able to triangulate sometimes these coronal mass ejections and get a good estimate of the speed with which these structures are traveling. So we get the speed almost right away. Once we have seen this and once we know the speed with which this is traveling, then one can calculate essentially at what speed will it go through the interplanetary medium, and there is a little bit of modeling involved there. And so the NOAA forecasters at that point actually begins, and we have good, reasonably decent models now. They begin to put out warnings to power grid operators, to satellite operators, to aviators, and everyone who is concerned about this. And depending on the speed, of course, we will say that it's going to come in 20 hours, or typically it is more like, 3 days. They travel, the speed is rarely this fast. So when you see such a fast CME liftoff from the surface of the sun, you already know that this is big. And so you begin to kind of warn people. And yeah. And we, meaning not us, but NOAA.
So in this particular case, I assume there would be a little calculation time, a little triangulation time, but it would have been something less than 19 hours, maybe 18 hours of warning.
Warning, yes. The minute the CME lifts, you do your calculations and you calculate the speed and you begin to give rough estimates in the beginning, and then you do your modeling and you get more precise as it's traveling, and we are tracking it because we have, heliospheric imagers that track these CMEs into interplanetary medium. So you keep refining it. But that, if it's coming in 20 hours, that's kind of your window, and we would have started pretty much right away, right in the beginning.
Great. So how would a citizen be warned, or if a citizen, say, wanted to say, well, I'd like to unplug my computers and do some things like that, how would we get in on that warning system? Is there a website to go to, or...?
Yes. So NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center, Boulder, Colorado. They actually put out these warnings, watches, alerts, just like terrestrial weather, there are levels that they put out. I think you could subscribe to their alerts, watches, or you could go to their website and find out, what exactly is happening, what is space weather now, whether the conditions are calm, are there any active regions on the sun that's brewing? You can get all that information. And of course, on the NASA side, we are providing most of the observations, the science analysis, and you can actually get a visual representations of what's happening on the sun and the real-time calculations of some of these events.
Now, I'd like to be sure that we continue to have satellite assays tracking the sun. How is the program Do the satellites need replacement at some point? And is there general support that this is a very important thing we're doing?
I would say that there is a recognition that this is an important thing to be doing, but there are so many important things to do. Mm-hmm. And so little resources available for that. So I can't say, that's why I mentioned, you know, today we are ideally placed and we are studying this, we are learning more science, all of that. But many of our satellites are actually aging satellites. STEREO, for example, which has been absolutely vital by providing the new perspective and the new science understanding of these coronal mass ejections, which leads to better forecasting, essentially. They are 8 years old. They are now behind or on the other side, far side of the sun, at 2 AU from us. And we are getting very limited amount of data from STEREO because of signal, because they're so far away. Solar Dynamics Observatory was launched in 2010. SOHO was launched in 1995, and one of the most important satellites, you know, which is kind of really the final satellite that tells us whether a solar storm is going to be a geomagnetic storm, is the ACE satellite, Advanced Composition Emission Satellite, and this is about 17 years old. With ACE, what happens is we actually measure the magnetic field strength and its direction. That is the first time we are able to figure out what magnetic signature this particular coronal mass ejection is carrying. Now, the strength of a CME is very much a function of the polarity of this embedded magnetic field, okay? And so the polarity dictates whether the storm will be short-lived, very strong, stronger storms, you know, all of this depends on that. And then how this is going to induce geomagnetic currents. And, you know, if you think of power grids, it's the geomagnetic currents that then begin to trip the voltage and transformers. And so ACE is in the final sort of line of this sun-earth distance of 93 million miles, which determines weather. So when we determine the polarity of the CME with ACE, from that point, we have roughly 30 minutes to say that this is going to be intense. Or this is, you know, the magnetic field strength is weak, so yes, there'll be some fluctuations. You know, that's when you determine the scale that NOAA puts out, you know, whether it's G1 to G5 storm, basically.
So that's 30 minutes of heads up on that one.
Right. And that satellite is, you asked the question, that satellite is 17 years old. However, I think soon, next year, in 2015, there'll be another satellite that will be launched, and this is working with NOAA. NASA is refurbishing this satellite called the Deep Space Climate Observatory, Discover, and in part, it'll be to replace ACE's capabilities, essentially. So we're kind of looking forward to that launch because that will provide the much-needed backup we need in case ACE were to fail today.
Right, right. Well, fantastic. So what I'd like to know is if there's anything that in this 2012 event that caused people who are maybe not on the science side, but more on the civilian infrastructure side or government infrastructure side, did they really come and take notice of this? Did it lead to an increased sort of sense of urgency around hardening our systems or that maybe there's more we could do to be ready for such an event if something like this did happen to come towards Earth?
I think the science papers have just been coming out. Mm-hmm. So there have been a lot of sort of presentations and of the science results that have come out, and people are beginning to pay more attention. So For example, at NASA, we have our advisory committees that are kind of beginning to ask the question, well, you know, what is the probability of such an event happening in 10 years, in 50 years? And we are trying to get a handle. Remember, now we are working with a situation of probability of low data, right? We have data only from sort of 50 years, and it's not a great way to extract probabilistic information if you're looking at 10, 50, 100 years. We don't have a lot of solid data, I would say. But these are the areas, these are the kind of questions we are beginning to ask and probably will go forward trying to answer in future with the observations that we have in place. And, you know, policymakers will have to make decisions at that point, because most of the system right now kind of depends quite a bit on research satellites and research models.
Right. Well, it's I remember from our last conversation, you said that the probability of one of these CMEs does go up with solar activity, but we're not really at a super solar in 2012. We were not in any super active part of the cycle. So just goes to show that that sometimes they do just sort of pop out. So, yep, without a whole lot of data, I guess getting solid statistics is hard.
Right. And in fact, you know, with solar cycle, the frequency of flares and coronal mass ejections will increase. That's just the frequency. The severity of any of these events has really little correlation with solar cycle phase, essentially. In fact, often the bigger storms have happened during the declining phase of the solar cycle. And that's what we are beginning to, and you know, I mean, interestingly enough, we are actually going now into the declining phase of the solar cycle. So the point I'd like to make is that we really don't know enough, and we cannot take our eyes off of the sun heliosphere system.
Well said, and I certainly support that. So what we're going to do is we'll put this out, and I'd love to drum up more interest in really talking about ways in which we could be better prepared, because, you know, 1859, historically speaking, not that far ago, 1989, not that far ago. So these things happen, and it would be great to know that we've sort of tested and gotten prepared, because the world is increasingly dependent on these technologies. Heck, I don't even know how I would get around without GPS anymore, right?
In fact, what is interesting, you know, I think I really am appreciating the way you are phrasing it. For too long, we are sort of caught up by the way we describe this phenomenon in the past. I think in the context of present, we need to rethink how to pose questions. So what do we mean by Carrington event? You often hear this word. If you think about it, as I mentioned, you know, Carrington event has become a touchstone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So researchers refer to it often when discussing severe solar storms and their possible effects on modern society. However, if you listen carefully, you will hear that Carrington event has two different meanings. So literally, we know it's the event itself, right? A series of solar flares and geomagnetic storms in September 1959. But operationally, what we are trying to say that this is a solar storm so severe that it can have widespread societal consequences. Now, pinning down the literal Carrington event is not easy, because it happened at a time when we didn't have space weather sensors and satellites. You know, there are very few data. So this is not easy. But what we need to do now is actually ask the question differently, okay? Because I think to bring our modern society to a halt, I don't think we need an event that is as large as a Carrington event. It could be much smaller, simply because of the connectedness of our power grid. and also the entire technological system, as you're saying. You know, we don't know how to operate without our GPS system. So we need to pose, maybe sort of change the way we ask the question. Instead of defining the storm and extrapolating the consequences from there, it might make more sense to start with a set of consequences and work backward to the storm. So we can say, you know, for instance, we define a modern Carrington event to be any storm, you know, that disturbs the ionosphere so badly that scintillation severely degrades GPS navigation and time transfer for at least 2 weeks. Now, what kind of storm condition would give rise to that? And that's why I was giving you that list in the beginning. When you ask someone big event, you know, it depends in what way, what impact are we looking at?
Well said. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it's a little unknowable to me. I just have a sense that we have a very interconnected, very interwoven, very electronically based society, and that much depends on that operating as is. And it wouldn't take much to disrupt it, because we know, for instance, you know, what happened in Fukushima shows us what happens when a nuclear power plant loses electricity. It's not a good thing. I think that's interesting to take it from the other direction and say, how much of a disruption are we willing to accept? And where's that threshold? And then try and map that back into what kind of an event we think from the sun would potentially precipitate that. And then you can say with, I think, greater sense of confidence, here's the probability of that happening.
Exactly, because right now we are in a place where we are always trying to do this Carrington event kind of event and determine consequences, and we don't have a good sense of that.
Yeah, just based on how the rest of the world works, it's probably a power law sort of a relationship. So it's you know, it's just hanging out over there as some very infrequent but very large thing that can happen, and we don't have enough data to really fit the curve and know what we're looking at yet.
You know, what's interesting is that some people of late think that we used to think that this is like a, you know, low probability, high impact event happens every 100 years or so. Some researchers are doing calculations, and I would just kind of treat it as research and research with small numbers, is that the probability could be much higher. Probability could be 10-12%. Now, that probability that they are referring to is, of course, a solar storm that would be so severe. But the impact side of it is something else, right? It still has to make that connection to actually have an impact on our environment. And we know very little about that.
Yes, interesting. Well, I really want to thank you so much for your time today. And I would invite anybody listening, take a look at that 2012 event. I just started to find some of the papers that have come out. I'll link to a couple of them. There's some nice presentations. There have been, it was the focus of a recent conference this past summer. And so it's really, there's a lot of data there. And it was pretty exciting, that we caught the data. So it tells us how important it is to be watching, and to be watching even in places that aren't directly aimed at us. And it's just fascinating, if you like science, to check out what this event was. And then thirdly is to really think through, if that had been pointed at us, then what? And I think those are questions that are, in my estimation, we're still at the early stage of asking. So I would invite people to explore them on their own. Lika, any last words there?
I think you summed it up very well, and if you're interested, I could provide you with some of our models that actually will show the propagation of these coronal mass ejections throughout the heliosphere. You know, anymore, our focus is just not on our planet. We have assets on every planet, pretty much. Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, they're all affected by these coronal mass ejection. And, you know, NASA has desire, of course, of leaving low Earth orbit and going into deep space voyage, go to Mars, Moon. And to do that, I think having an understanding of these phenomenon, you know, sort of almost taking a step from so-called space weather into the domain of interplanetary space weather.
I hadn't thought of that, the fact that we have those assets on the other planet. So, yes, please send those models along. I'd love to take a look at them and dig into this a little bit more deeply. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for your time today.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Chris.